All right, let's get into it. Welcome to episode 17 of the Citizen Curious podcast. I am your host, Ryan Lee. We are broadcasting live and direct, as always, from the ultra-secretive, highly confidential location in Lower Manhattan, known as the Carmine Street Studios, aka my apartment, and more specifically, my kitchen table. We've got a great episode ahead of us, so I'm just going to tell you who today's guest is. I am very pleased to announce that the guest is Steve Lavin. Yes, Coach Steve Lavin, men's basketball head coach of two of the most storied programs in college sports, UCLA, that's my alma mater, and St. John's University out here in New York City. He's also had an extensive broadcasting career calling games for ABC and ESPN with Brent Musburger, and most recently Fox Sports, CBS Sports, and the Pac-12 Network. It's a broad and far-reaching conversation about hoops, life, coaching, a little bit of John Wooden, philosophy. We hit on everything. This episode was really, really fun, really gratifying, because I actually have a small personal connection to Coach Lav. It dates almost 25 years. When I was in the fourth grade, I ended up attending the Lavin summer basketball camps that he and his family would put on during the summer up in the Napa Valley out in California. It was truly a family operation. His dad worked there, his sister. And to get me signed up to go to the camp, his dad actually called our house one night and had this epic one-hour conversation with my dad. They talked about their time spent in San Francisco, their favorite restaurants, their favorite bars. It was absolutely amazing. Ended up going a couple years in a row. Members of the UCLA basketball team were counselors. That included the O'Bannon brothers, both Ed and Charles, Tyus Edney, Cameron Dollar. And at that age, I'm 11, 12 years old. Those guys are larger than life, both the players and the coaches. UCLA ends up winning the national championship during the 94-95 season. And then Coach Lav becomes head coach a couple years later. And obviously, I've been a major supporter of his from the jump. I ended up transferring to UCLA, having some of the best years of my life in Westwood. It's all good. So to sit at my kitchen table in New York City last weekend, we recorded this on a Sunday afternoon, and being a UCLA Bruin and knowing my family's connection to his family through the camps, to be able to sit down and have a great chat with him, it was just really fun. And it's kind of surreal. You know, I'm not going to lie, it's kind of surreal. We ended up having a great conversation. A lot got left on the editing room floor, but that's for another podcast maybe. So I just want to say, Coach Lav, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to reconnect with you. And without further ado, here is my interview with Coach Steve Lavin. I went to your camps, and it was probably 93, 94 up in Angwin. You know, one, it was those were the best basketball camps that I've ever went to. They're absolutely amazing.
I appreciate that.
And yeah, and how I end up going is your dad called my house and talked to my parents, and I'd gone to bed. So he must have called the house around like 8:30, 9 o'clock or something. And I remember I woke up the next morning and my parents said, "Oh yeah, you're going to Lavin basketball camp."
Wow.
And I was like, "All right, well, it sounds good to me." You know, like what, how did this come about? What you haven't mentioned this recently. And my dad starts telling me a story. He goes, "Oh, well, Steve Lavin's dad called me or called the house and wanted to see if you were going to participate." And we ended up talking about San Francisco because we both grew up in SF. And so basically the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree when it comes to recruiting, but your dad just ended up talking to my parents for like an hour about living in SF. And then we signed up that night. We were all in.
Amazing. Yeah. One is that's, you know, so true to form when it comes to my father. He just had that natural way because of his interest in people. We talked about neighborhoods and the city, and the era that he grew up in San Francisco was so unique and such a special time. And it's always special, but I think he grew up in a really unique time for another podcast. We'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah.
But he had that ability. That's what made him a great teacher. He just, his authenticity and his interest in people and ideas and wanting to share and, you know, introduce others to music and literature. And, you know, he always had some suggestions in terms of a list of, you know, books that he thought would be a good read. And it was tailored to each person that he met. So in other words, it wasn't just, you know, a New York Times bestseller that he thought everyone should read, but it was based on their upbringing, their current place in life, the juncture, the intersection that they were in, whether it was a younger person or someone getting up there in age. And he really enjoyed directing people for, you know, it could be haiku poetry. It could be James Joyce. It could be C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. It could be Walden. He just had, and it was also contemporary, might be something on media, you know, Postman on media, or McLuhan, two writers he turned me on to at a young age. When I look back at it now, it's like, wow, my dad was giving me you know, books written by Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman, I think, who later might have coached at NYU. I mean,
the keys to modern NYU. Media. Yeah,
exactly. And almost like clairvoyant, like he had a crystal ball that he knew I was going to end up coaching in UCLA, in Los Angeles, in New York. But that's a great story you shared, and about my father calling and engaging with your parents. And he had that X factor. There was a writer that came out to do an article, you know, I think it was during my first year at UCLA. And so naturally interviewed my dad, and he fell in love with my dad to the point where the article ended up being on my father, which I loved. That was a compliment. You know, people like, wait a second, it was supposed to be on you. I was like, oh, you don't understand. You got to meet my father. Like, this is just the way it works.
And it's a good reminder of when you take a genuine interest in whether it's a subject or people. And when you're not seeking necessarily a reward, we live in such like a rewards driven society where you expect to get recognition in return. But when you do something that is authentic, people pick up on that energy.
Yeah, it's a really important distinction, because the gist also, I think, of what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is there was no motive other than the interest and the joy of, you know, discovering. And that's back
understanding
to
what, how the world works for the sake of it.
Yeah. And so in sharing that joy, then all these other gifts present and possibilities exponentially grow, even though you're not after those. You're just wanting to have a good conversation, or you're outside trying to get some fresh air and get your steps in and take the dog with you for the walk. And along the way, you meet some interesting people. And if you take that metaphor, you know, you could apply it to other experiences and other paths in life.
I can see how those life experiences just make you more present and open and force you to relate to people, because certainly as a coach, you know, you're going out and recruiting all sorts of different people that all have different, come from different walks of life and, you know, different backgrounds. And it helps you to relate to people. My primary passion, like, I love music. And so I've studied, you know, all the greats and read all the biographies. And I think it's the, you know, there's a famous quote by Bob Dylan where someone asked him, well, when do you write your best songs? He says, when I'm living my life the most, essentially. It's to that degree.
Love it.
Right. I'll just stay with this tangent. Something that's unique about coaching is that you age, but the players stay the same age. And so you have to reinvent yourself. You have to communicate in new ways.
Yep. A couple of thoughts on that insight of, you know, as parents, as, you know, coaches, we get older, teachers, and oftentimes we're working different with parents, of course, because your kids get older too. But with teaching and coaching your students, and your players are 18 to 22, and you start recruiting them when they're probably 15 or 16. So there's like that 6-year window, let's call it 16 to 22. And Coach Wooden, in his brilliance, each spring at UCLA would take a psychology class, audit the class, just sit in on it, because he knew he was getting older, and yet he was coaching those 18 to 22-year-olds. And also with what was happening in the world, you know, you think about when he started coaching at Indiana State when I was a teacher's college. He was in the Navy as well. He started in high school, Dayton, Kentucky, at Dayton High School, and then South Bend Central High School, where he was teaching and coaching. And then Indiana State, a teacher's college, which is interesting because back to teaching. And they were Division II. It was before, you know, the Sycamores, now Division I, with Larry Bird, the great history they have. Mm-hmm. But this was prior to that. And then he had the education of being in the service in the Navy. Comes to UCLA as UCLA 27 years. But if you look at the arc of when he was coaching, he coached GI Bill guys that had come back from World War II. You know, they'd been in Iwo Jima and Normandy and Germany. So he also, you know, coached during the Korean War. He coached during civil rights.
That's wild.
You know, he coached during the, you know, anti-establishment, you know, generation. So
Vietnam era, Bill Walton, right? Vietnam. Like almost an insurrectionist on the team.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he had this wonderful gift. He was flexible enough, and you have to be interested. And he knew psychology was going to be the most important element to his coaching career because he had been a Hall of Fame player and obviously he was doing well as a coach, but to stay on top, he knew to bring forth the best in the young people he's working with, it was going to be psychology, motivation. And his ultimate goal was to get closer to the full expression of individuals' potential as well as the team's potential. And I think it's back to that. He was interested.
I think it's fascinating. I'm just sort of thinking in like the third person here, but how an experience of me going to your basketball camp when I was fourth grade has led us to have this like abstract life conversation about life philosophies, essentially. Here we are, you know.
Attitudes. Big A.
Yeah, attitude right? Yeah. So, all right. So I'm going to tell you the things I remember. We'll close the loop on my time in Angwin. I'll tell you the things I remember. Stance.
Big one.
I remember that was big time. No one had ever instilled defense in me. You guys would yell out stance wherever we were.
I think even in the morning, I think even during wake up call, we'd knock on doors, open the doors.
Yeah, you'd yell stance.
And you'd have to in your bed still pop up and catch a ball that we fired off a pass to you or get your stance outside of the bed. Yeah, we're always drilling those habits, right? Yeah.
Your dad, watching him, we were all gathered around the 3-point line and he would just go to the free throw line and he would shoot 100 free throws. And he would make about 97 of them.
Yep.
But he would talk and he would just freestyle. He would be reciting poetry. He'd be telling us about the classics. He'd be weaving in similar to our conversation. We're bouncing all over the place.
He actually won the trip that my parents took on their honeymoon to Hawaii was a result of hitting 23 out of 25 free throws in a free throw contest. And it was, you know, two tickets, round trip to Hawaii. And so, and he shot them after coming from Reardon High School, where he was teaching English and coaching basketball mm-hmm. at that point. And so he came straight from teaching English and he actually still had his floor shimes, his wingtips on with his khakis and his, you know, Oxford button down, just rolled up the sleeves, dropped 23 out of 25, amazing. Picks up the two tickets from, I think, a United or American Airlines. And they obviously needed that with the kids. That point they probably had three or four kids, eventually six, so that went a long way. And I think they've been married a couple of years, and that's was the makeup honeymoon trip that they didn't get to take because they obviously couldn't afford mm-hmm. it when they were, my mom was 19, my dad was 22, I think, when they married. They were together 60 years. I can imagine if I put myself in your shoes or some third, fourth, fifth, sixth graders, who's this old guy in his 60s coming out making all these free throws? A little different than LeBron or, you know, Kobe.
You end up at UCLA, and I think that what would be interesting to know is you were named the interim head coach. You're a younger guy. You were in your like early 30s, right?
Yes.
When you were
31 going on 32, I think. Yeah.
That's crazy in itself, right? I mean, that to be put into the spotlight at that type of an institution at that age, I mean, you were 7 years younger than me at the time, which is wild.
Yeah. And also not that, you know, it's interesting now, like the players I coached in that era are in their 40s. And then my St. John's kids are in their mid-20s to late-20s. So it's almost like the two marriages where you've got, you know, the first set of children, which were my UCLA guys. Right. And then you've got, you know, the second marriage with the second set of children, which are my St. John's guys. And they inform. We talked earlier about Coach Wooden with the psychology classes and the assistant coach that he hired. But my players inform me and my teaching. And, you know, because I've got the guys closer to my age. And then I've got the ones much younger than me, and both are really helpful because it's almost three generations.
Yeah. What is it? What is the interview process like to become the head coach of UCLA?
At UCLA, right. Because I'd already been on staff for 5 years and we had won a national title and the relationships were already there. So when Coach Herrick was dismissed, they initially hire me on an interim basis and they say it may be a week, it may be a month. It might be half the season. It might be all the season. We're going to do a national search and you know, look to bring in a high profile candidate. And so I was just signing on to hold the fort down because I was the first assistant, had the most tenure of anyone on the staff. I was the recruiting coordinator and was a part of, you know, the run, a remarkable run that Coach Herrick had at UCLA for 8 years. And then we moved down the line and they're doing a national search and we had our struggles early, but then we start to find our stride. Well, the struggles and then eventually finding the stride and then just being the head coach of UCLA because of the scrutiny, the spotlight that is UCLA basketball. That was my interview. Looking back on it now, I see that. Now, when I was in the midst of it, I wasn't aware of it. But once they eventually hired me, Chuck Young, who was the chancellor, Pete Blackman, who was the vice chancellor and had played for Coach Wooden in the 60s, right before the dynasty started. Pete Blackman was on those teams. Those two brought me to Bel Air Country Club. And obviously very memorable. It was at the grill of Bel Air Country Club. And I remember I ordered a turkey burger, well done with cheddar cheese only, French fries, and a Diet Coke. And we had a conversation up there, which in a sense was part of an interview, but they offered me the job while I was there, you know, at the end of that lunch. And then they announced it the next day. And then we flew to Arizona. And that was the beginning of a 12-game win streak. So there were a lot of pieces in it. And I think, you know, again, something I found out more in retrospect, that the most pivotal piece was Coach Wood. And, you know, that's not something I share a great deal of the time publicly, but it made sense once I found out that, you know, he wasn't publicly advocating me for me, but behind the scenes because he knew Chuck Young, because Chuck was a young chancellor when John Wooden retired and he had coached Pete Blackman, he had coached Jim Millhorn. So he had basically, and naturally, you know, they lean on him. And, but he wasn't the type that was forceful by any means. I'm not saying like Al Davis.
Coach Wood, not a style, yeah.
No, but just in a subtle way. And that was like, hey, he's here. There's continuity. You know, he's done well as an assistant. You know, obviously it could always down the line go a different direction. It doesn't work out, which they did 7 years later. But I was really fortunate to have that tie to Purdue.
And he knew you. I mean, you had a year-long friendship. So he seemed like someone who was a pretty good judge of character, and he was not a judgmental person, but he was a good judge of character. And you know, you had a pretty extensive relationship with him by this point.
So yeah, by that
probably
point,
I'd imagine he'd speak honestly and unbiased about who you were as a person.
Yeah. By that time it was 8 years. So, or let's say seven, maybe two. So I probably didn't meet him my first year at Purdue, but say second year I meet him. And then the five that I was at UCLA as an assistant. So there was good rapport and spent, you know, a great deal of time with him and a lot of time on the phone. As a matter of fact, he was the first one to give me an inclination while I was working, you know, under the interim conditions. It might've been early January where I said, well, you know, at some point, Coach, you know, it appears because we were struggling that we're going to get a lot of time together this spring and more time than usual because it appeared that, you know, I wasn't going to be the head coach. And he said, I get the idea that you might be busier than you've ever been in your life.
There was that blowout loss to Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to know, how you process that, because one of the qualities of, I think, you as a coach in your teams, you always bend, but you don't break. And you've always had this unique ability to snap back. Given that time period, you're the new coach, spotlight is on you, you're under the microscope. You're thinking, I'm coming up for either an extension on this season at least, or I'm going to be shown the door. And then you lose pretty seriously to Stanford. How did you center yourself and reframe, like we've talked about before?
Yeah, a couple items there. Is first, what's interesting is we did have the ability to bounce back. And I think that's so important, right? Like Michigan State this year, they really went through struggles, but now they've won three, maybe even four in a row, and are playing their best basketball. And that was something that I was brought up in terms of my coaching mentors. You know, November and December, you're still in the laboratory, so to speak, you know, tinkering with the test tubes, trying to find the chemistry, because coaching is like being an alchemist. And if you don't kind of try different combinations and stay open to what are the best possibilities, then I think you really underserve, you know, your team. But the first 6 years, while there was kind of this perception of, you know, wow, they're really inconsistent, the interesting thing is, if you look at the numbers, our non-conference winning percentage, our conference winning percentage, and our NCAA tournament,
pretty consistent.
Our NCAA tournament percentage were just the opposite. They were almost shockingly consistent. Like you couldn't, if you tried, you couldn't get them to be so close. Non-conference, conference, NCAAs were almost identical, mid-60s maybe, you know, in terms of winning percentage. So that's interesting. But again, I think LA and the spotlight. And so how you take that report card from a loss and from the box score to the game film and getting with your staff and really focus in on what are the areas we need to improve upon. We got to shore those areas up, eliminate the things that went in to us losing. And therefore, if we eliminate those things, we increase the percentages of winning, not guaranteed. But we're talking about probabilities or odds. And that's the way I was raised by Coach Katie and Coach Knight and Krzyzewski and Tark and my mother and father, in terms of outside of basketball, how we improve and grow is to work on the areas we're weak, those deficiencies, try and neutralize them. Sometimes we even turn them into strengths. That's a real blessing where you take a weakness and it becomes a strength. And that's what Magic Johnson did. He came into the NBA from Michigan State. His weaknesses were free throw shooting and three-point shooting. And at one point or another throughout his career, he led the NBA in free throw shooting and he led the NBA in three-point shooting. So he took two deficiencies. That's why he's a Hall of Famer, one of the greatest to ever play this game. Things that were he was deficient in, and turn them into something where he was the best in the world in those respective statistics in given seasons, not every year, but that just shows you. So to the Stanford game, I wasn't as concerned, even though it made a big headline, and my dad would always tease me. He said, well, you created the moniker, because in the post game I called the Naples Massacre, or maybe a couple days later throughout that season, I referred to it as the Maples Massacre. He said, why, you know, you create the own monikers that they use against you. Stop doing that. You know, he said it turned out to be a good thing for broadcasting, but not so much as a head coach. Right. But I think that goes back to my parents, you know, insight, being able to laugh at circumstances, to laugh at our own circumstances. And they were able to do that, raising six children on an educator's salary and through the challenges of, you know, being together 60 years, as wonderful as it was. Not every day is perfect. It's not happy days or my three sons. And they set such a great example in terms of, you know, how you stay with it, whether it's your marriage, whether it's, you know, in school or in athletics. The key is to continue to grow and learn. And so that's what I always took the most pride in, was how do we get our team back on track? In that game, I don't think we even watched highlights, because we had such a quick turnaround. We had to play at the Cal Palace, I think Haas Pavilion, Cal's home gym at that time was being renovated, or for some reason it wasn't available. So we actually played the Cal Palace, which was beautiful, because that's where my father played a number of times when he was at the University of San Francisco in the what would that be, late 40s, early 50s. So something special, full circle. My dad is back in the Cal Palace behind our bench supporting us, and to be able to coach with my family there. Dan Belomny and Barry Tompkins had the call. It was a good Cal team. They ended up going to the Sweet 16. If I'm not mistaken, they might have upset Cal. I think they had like Tony Gonzalez, Randy Duck. Mm-hmm. You know, they had just a really strong team. Sean Marks. It was a
That was the Ben Braun era.
That might have been Ben Braun's first year. And so
they went to the Sweet 16 today. They put together a nice little run.
Matter of fact, we beat them that day, which is important because we got the business trip split. We lost to Stanford. I locked in on let's get this business trip split and beat Cal. Now we don't realize how good Cal is at the time. They came down to Pauley, if I'm not mistaken, and beat us later in the year. And that might have been our last loss before winning 12 straight. I think we lost to Cal. I get the job, you know, after we beat Stanford. So at home, we lose to Cal. We come back and crush Stanford at Pauley.
Yeah.
And then I have a meeting at Hotel Bel Air at the Grill. I'm sorry, the Bel Air Country Club at the Grill. Get the job. Then we go to Arizona. We went 12 straight.
In some ways, are you grateful or relieved that you were able to coach there before you added in the social media layer and how that might have been a different experience for you?
Yeah. It was still, you know, what's interesting now when I watch UCLA basketball, for whatever reason, it just doesn't receive the amount of attention that it did during, you know, Coach Herrick's era, my era, into Ben Howland's era. It was a big deal. I mean, people, you know, from attendance to letters to the editor on Saturday, you know, two columnists that would write, you know, their columns about the outcome of the game, good or bad, plus the beat writer. Plus Page Two, you know, these are my friends, TJ Simers, who I really got a kick out of and enjoyed his sense of humor. And
you know, it definitely feels like some of the prestige has worn off a little bit.
Yeah, just not. And maybe it's such a saturated market. I can't put my finger on what it is, or because everything's gone digital, you know, the LA Times isn't read by as many people, and probably not as many of those are delivered to homes. But back in the day, I mean, the LA Times, you know, they covered USC football. Authoritative. They covered USC football and UCLA basketball, kind of like pro sports. I mean, obviously the Dodgers, Lakers, I'm not saying it was the same in terms of, you know, the year-round coverage, but when they covered USC football and UCLA basketball, it was as though we were pro sports. And St. John's is that way in New York. So interestingly, the two markets, and I'm grateful because that really helped inform the perspective that I bring to my broadcasting. And I also think it was a real break. I don't think it's a coincidence that so many of our players from that era are in broadcasting now. You know, Don McLean does broadcasting. Sean Farnham and John Crispin, two of my players, are ESPN. Earl Watson's doing work in broadcasting as well, both the NBA and the Pac-12 networks. So Matt Barnes, you know, who Steven Jackson has, you know, I think all the smoke.
He's got a HBO great podcast. That podcast is A+.
I agree. Just authentic and real and entertaining and insightful and so thought provoking. But I think it's, you know, this just like for me, it was working in these media markets has been a bridge to broadcast.
Now I have a question for you just along the, recruiting side, and when you do have players, whether you're at UCLA or St. John's, but players that have the potential to go pro, how did you view your role in that process when someone had the potential to go pro?
Yeah, number one, I mean, sounding board is definitely part of the role, at least in my view, that a coach ideally should play to be able to listen. And I didn't want to advocate for a particular agent. I was aware of, you know, who were agents that were reputable. You know, how I saw as a naive, relatively speaking, at 32 years old and a head coach at UCLA with no prior head coaching experience, it was more listening and trying to help the players and the families arrive at a place where they were informed and accurately informed, because there's a big difference. Sometimes they're misinformed informed in an inaccurate way. And so, for instance, you know, for me, calling Elgin Baylor, calling Jerry West, calling Randy Fund, I could call friends, people I knew in the business, put them on speakerphone and ask about, you know, where one of my players was, and the player could hear, you know, what Jerry West or Elgin Baylor or Randy Fund were saying. You know, if it's the right time, then, you know, I want that player at St. John's. I had Mo Harkless, you know, he came one year and he ended up being the 15th pick of the draft. He's had a couple stops. He's now at the Miami Heat. Amir Garrett, you know, left us at St. John's because he had a gift as a pitcher. And now is, you know, with the Cincinnati Reds, Major League Baseball player, having a terrific career.
Yep.
And Baron Davis was a third pick. You know, Jerome Moiso was the 10th pick. So I'm, you know, now there's also situations like Jerron Rush. I would have preferred he came back another year. But so many of our players stayed 4 years and then had long careers in the NBA. Matt Barnes was 13 or 14 years, but he played for us for 4 years at UCLA. Earl Watson played for us for 4 years.
Capone stayed for all four.
Capone stayed all four, and I think he played 10 years in the NBA. Earl Watson played 13 years in the NBA and stayed all four. Dan Gudzerik, 8 to 10 years in the NBA. He stayed all four. So,
Gadzooks.
Yeah. And so, you know, the guys that stayed 4 years not only helped us win and deliver, but they also were more prepared, and, you know, their preparedness, their readiness for the NBA is what allowed them to stay 10 years, 12 years, 13, 14 years, and also have that pension. So they're set for life.
Yeah.
And it's a fine line, you know, because you don't want to have a player come back, you know, if, you know, he's had an injury prior and, you know, he has a window, like Baron had the knee injury. And so, you know, he's going to be the third pick in the draft, and you've got solid intel that's confirming that, then, you know, you need to encourage him to go, not force him. I mean, if he ultimately was going to fight to come back, then, you know, that's free will. That's his choice, you know, but also present that, hey, if you come back and re-injure yourself, you may never get back to a place where you're the third pick and could ultimately make $100 or more million, you know, and then think about interest and, you know, and your family down the line, your own children and grandchildren and whatnot. So, but in essence, to boil it down, it's to be the bridge to information and people that are informed so that the prospect, his family, you know, your player has the opportunity to use critical thinking skills and make a decision that's informed, that can influence or affect the rest of their lives.
So let's ask a few questions about the St. John's era, and then we'll do a little rapid fire round at the end here.
Okay.
Curious to know, before you took on the job at St. John's, were you getting the itch to get back in the game?
Yeah. So, you know, initially the first year out, you go through withdrawal because it was the first time since I was 10 years old where I wasn't part of the team, starting at St. Anselm's in Northern California, you know, playing for that parish. And then, you know, junior high, high school, college, and then coaching for all those years as an assistant. And so,
and there's a consistency to the season.
Of exactly.
Just getting it started. And, and then, you know, being college, you go into league play and then you're gearing up for the tournament. And there's a consistency and a pattern to it, I imagine, is a little bit jarring your first year out.
No doubt. So if you start playing at 10, then I was fired at 38 from UCLA, right? So that's 28 years as a player, as an assistant, and as a head coach. And suddenly you're in broadcasting and it's a new career. You're learning the fundamentals, the mechanics of broadcasting. That takes time. And in terms of finding your voice, a comfort level, like any new career, vocation, or craft. But I missed the camaraderie with the kids and the camaraderie with your staff. And that group working towards kind of common goals, trying to win a championship. I missed the routine, the competition at the highest level, and that adrenaline rush, nothing like it, making runs through the tournament. And just seeing young people develop, being on a campus, I think is really intoxicating, kind of stimulating, because you're working with Nobel Prize, Pulitzer Prize winners when you're at an institution like UCLA, and people in the research that are trying to find cures for cancer, and just so much is happening there. And I find that really stimulating and intoxicating because of my parents having, you know, an interest in education and the arts. my dad teaching on college campuses. So the first year was really tough just in terms of withdrawal. And then my second, third year, I started to really enjoy it. And part of that's being partnered with Brent. And, you know, we're doing the ABC game of the week. And then we're doing Tuesday nights in the Big Ten. And I was in studio on Wednesday nights. And I'd come back into the Big Ten. And just a blast, because with the game of the week, you're all over the country calling different conferences. And then really dropping in on the Big Ten during the week and then getting some studio time. So it was.
What's the travel schedule for like that for game of the week? Are you bombing in day of and then out of there as soon as the game's over?
It was crazy. That during the season when we really were hopping, you know, it really picks up in January. You know, I would leave Los Angeles and fly to the site of the Big Ten game, get in there the night before, day before, try and catch practice. If not, the next day,
So you go the day before.
I'd head that way the day before. Try and get in the time for practice. If it didn't, I'd try and get the shoot around the next day. And sometimes you hit the practice and you hit the shoot around, depending where your feel is in terms of, okay, how much research? Do we have enough? You know, and obviously you want to watch the opposing team practice as well. Call that game. That's on Tuesday. All right. Wednesday, get up, fly to Bristol, do studio on Wednesday. Thursday, get up early, fly to the site of another Big Ten game and call it that night. Then Friday, get up, fly to the site of Saturday's ABC game, call that game. We were out on the East Coast, 3 o'clock, done with that game. And on the West Coast, even earlier, right? Because the time zone change. And then I would fly home Saturday night to LA, and I'd be at home Saturday night, Sunday. Then Monday, I'd get up and fly back to the site of a Big Ten game, do the game Tuesday, hit studio Wednesday in Bristol, go back to a Big Ten site Thursday, Friday, get up, fly to the game of the week on Saturday. So that was a wild, you know, 2.5, 3 months, you know, schedule.
Yeah.
And I'd get home just enough to, you know, pick up some dry cleaning, run a couple errands, check, you know, pay my bills, and then you're out, you know. So, but I enjoyed it, you know, because I was learning so much, because you're working with Brent Musburger, Aaron Andrews was our sideline reporter, and it was a chance to watch practices, sit in on some game film sessions, you know, see how coaches were, you know, delegating responsibilities to assistants. I was checking out the facilities. Obviously, you're keeping an eye on assistants in case, you know, young assistants, like grad assistants, in case you come back to coaching, they can be potential prospects that you tap to come work with you. And just seeing everything through a wider angle lens, you know, when you're a head coach, you're kind of locked in myopic on your team, the upcoming opponent, their personnel, and your recruits. And that's your world.
You don't have any time for any other type of a view. To zoom out like that, you just don't have that luxury. It's go time.
Yeah. Exactly. And then in broadcasting, you really widen the lens and you're back in kind of a learning mode. And so it really increases your basketball acumen, almost like comparative literature, because you have your own experience as a head coach and assistant coach. Now, as a broadcaster, you get to watch other people at work in the same profession of coaching, but detached from it. And also, you know, coaches, when you're broadcasting, they allow you to come in because you're no longer competing against them. And so Lute Olson, you know, is going to, you know, take me out to dinner after the game. And I'm going to get to learn from a Hall of Famer. You know, Coach Olson and I had a good relationship when we were coaching against one another. We were actually pen pals. And he was someone that always just had grace and class. He was a true ambassador for the game. And he was the same. I mean, we had success against Arizona, but he was the same guy with a handshake and a handwritten note that would come shortly after, as he was when he beat you. You know, so just he really was that ideal of, you know, humble in victory and gracious in defeat, which is hard to do, right, in terms of sportsmanship. But that is what, you know, a coach Wooden set the standard on, a Coach Olson, who in my book is as good as anyone in the history of basketball as a coach.
The Desert Fox. Every level.
Unbelievable. And it's hard. It's hard, you know, to keep that consistency. Kipling's If, one of my favorite poems. It's a poem to his son, but it's all about that balance. And, you know, basically translating to coaching to sport is, you know, can you have as much class and dignity and grace when you're successful as when you're struggling? And boy, that is when you've won. Because it's not easy to do, but it's what the people that I admire and respect the most in the history of sport and colleagues manage that is really what to me is true character. A lot of people give lip service to character, but that is in real time. How does someone act when they lose, and they're struggling, and how do they act when they win? And trying to keep that middle ground is the ideal. But the itch started to come in year, maybe the end of 5, definitely in 6. And by 7, I was ready. But, I had turned down NC State. I forget what year it was. It might have been 2005 or 6. I'd only been out 2 or 3 years. And the job kind of fell to me. They were initially pursuing John Beilein, who was at West Virginia, but he had a huge buyout. As that buyout dropped, that is what led him eventually going to Michigan. And Tubby Smith, there was some tie. I think maybe he was from North Carolina originally. He was at Kentucky and turned.
Is this post-Kentucky? Yeah.
Yeah, he was still at Kentucky, but NC State went after him. Lee Fowler was the athletic director. Was a good friend, someone I really admired. I got to know through the NCAA tournaments because he was head of the selection committee and on the selection committee through the years. So he was at our sights, through my tenure at UCLA and really was actually there for some of our biggest wins. I think over Cincinnati, maybe Xavier, Michigan, had some big tournament wins and just coincidentally, he'd be there. And he liked cigars. I have an appreciation for Cuban cigars as well. And so we'd exchange cigars and keep in touch. And he eventually called and said, look, are you interested in coming to NC State? So we were at about, I feel like it was 2 or 3 weeks. And I had some really good conversations with Coach Wooden at that point about decision-making and critical thinking and the whole idea of going back or not going back. And he gave some priceless advice and that's for another podcast, but he plays a big part and not in telling me what to do, but in asking the questions that elicited responses and kind of brought forth my thinking that I wasn't even aware of because the questions hadn't been asked. And so while we want to have self-examined experiences, but often those come by people that care about us that can bring their perspective and ask questions that help clarify our own thinking, therefore to make better decisions. And that was an intersection or juncture where Coach Wooden, like a guardian angel, just hit on all the right notes and asked all the right questions that led to me realizing I didn't want to go back yet. And I think part of it was I wasn't fully recharged in terms of recharging the batteries from the 12 years at UCLA. And partly I was really enjoying my work. So there's this kind of interesting inner conflict that I knew I wanted to coach at some point, and I thought I'd make a return to coaching. And yet I couldn't believe that, and partly Coach wouldn't help me with this, that I didn't want to go to NC State. And so I returned to ESPN, and then in 2010, St. John's comes along, and that was just a straight sprint across the finish line. It all happened within 4 days. I think they called me on a Thursday, and maybe Monday I was announcing it at the Garden, or Tuesday. We had the press conference at the Garden, then we had the campus press conference on Wednesday. So maybe it was a 5 or 6 day window. I'm up at Bristol, it's the Sweet 16 weekend. And I'm at a deli having some matzo ball soup in West Hartford. And I get a call and someone says, are you interested in the St. John's job? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, someone's going to call you in 5 minutes. And then I got a call from first a friend of mine in coaching who tells me someone else is going to call me. And that's going to be the athletic director. And they're going to bring you to campus and interview you. And if you like it, it's going to be your job. It's like, wow. So I drove down there, I guess, on Monday morning, finished up at ESPN on Sunday night, drove to New York on Monday morning, interviewed Monday night in Tribeca at a steakhouse. Tuesday, Chris Monash, the athletic director I had dinner with, drives me to campus.
What's with you and these country clubs, these like steakhouses, to have these pivotal job offering meetings?
I think that's usually where it happens, right? It's like when you're in LA, it's a Bel Air Country Club. And in New York, I was staying at the Hudson, actually a boutique hotel, fun spot. And then I forget the name of the steakhouse in Tribeca. And then that was his call, not mine. And then we drove to campus and we met with Coach Carnesecca, Father Harrington, Father Marr, and a few others, Rob Weil, who's the number 2 or number 3 at St. John's. And I checked out the offices And next thing you know, we're having a press conference that night. So that was probably Tuesday night. And then Wednesday was on campus. So it was about a 5-day window. And, but that was no doubt. I knew New York, they had struggled for a decade. So yeah, it intrigued me. I'd been at UCLA where we did really well. Coach Wooden's standards, unparalleled. Coach Wooden was amazing. Coach Herrick had done well. I was an assistant part of that. So sustaining it, that was fun. But this was a new challenge, other side of the country.
Yeah, like,
the Big
East. A rebrand, like tarnish it off a little bit.
Completely.
Yeah.
And Madison Square Garden, I'd been in there as an assistant. I brought in teams, UCLA as a head coach. I broadcast games there with Brent, you know, calling St. John's Duke games, NIT games. But to come in as the head coach and it's your home court, that was, and, you know, my dad had played in the old garden in the 40s, early 50s. But that element was just like, wow. And it revealed and was a good fit. And, you know, I inherited a great group of seniors and to be able to take them to the tournament. And then we had to start over with our second year. We didn't have one returner, or maybe we did. We had one. Malik Stith was our only returner. He left at Christmas. And so then this new group of players, and then taking them through their senior year, going back to the NCAA tournament, kind of bookends of tournaments. With bookends of great seniors, a group that we inherited that I love. We call them the Redeem Team. And then this group that we got to raise and see them graduate with an NCAA tournament. And good timing too, because when I was fired at UCLA, it allowed me to spend time with my father before he died. And when I was fired at St. John's, it allowed me to spend time with my mom before she died. So this incredible arc of gifts revealing when you look back at the kind of arc of your life and career, it's like, wow. Because the regret I would have had if I was focused on trying to win games or get recruits or raise money with donors and boosters as my dad was dying or my mom was dying. And so these sabbaticals or these gaps, this time between coaching stops to be able to caretake for my parents before they died was arguably the greatest gift of my life, you know, because they bring us in and to be able to experience that process as they go out helps with minimizing the regret, you know, which is naturally there if you are distracted or your work or trying to earn a living limits your ability to caretake for your parents at that point in juncture as they're headed to the finish line. And with that said, you know, I know you also mentioned, would I want to go back to coaching? If there was the right fit, yes. You know, I really enjoy and I'm grateful for broadcasting and the people I've worked with, just the friendships developed in broadcasting. And the time away helps to recharge and increases your acumen. You're learning about the new trends, better ways, better methods in terms of if I were to return, because of the things that you learn, not only in life experience, but in observing other people at work. And, but it has to be a good fit, because also if the right fit didn't present, there's not a mutual embrace. I also realize, having lived life that, you know, things happen for a reason and the gifts have always revealed.
You can't force it.
No.
All right. Thank you so much, Coach. Let's do the rapid fire round. Do you feel the Golden State Warriors fan base owes you
some type of acknowledgement for the dynasty that's in place? You know where I'm going with this?
Bob Myers.
I read that you were the one who said, man, you try out for the team, try to get a walk-on spot. I think you'd be a good addition. Give it your all. So without Bob Myers being on the basketball team at UCLA, does he then go work for Arne Tellem? Does he then go help to architect the Warriors dynasty? All at the encouragement of Coach Lev. Do you feel the Warriors Nation owes you just a little bit of a thank you?
that is so funny. I mean, it's really amazing. His height, we can even go back further. And his father attended Purdue. So Bob Myers' father attended Purdue.
Wow.
So when Bob and his father came down to UCLA to visit, and we had these little partitioned offices at that time, they've since, you know, renovated the J.D. Morgan Center, the athletic department offices, and now assistants have their own offices. But at that point, Bob came down. I was an assistant, and he came down and met with me because I knew his high school coach, Jeff Corey, at Monta Vista High School. Jeff Corey and I were recruited by the same junior college coach, a guy named Bud Presley at Menlo Junior College. I didn't end up going to Menlo, but we were both recruited by the same coach. Jeff Corey and I met at a Mike Krzyzewski coaches clinic in Durham, where we stayed in the dorms. And we were also with a coach named Mike LaGarza, who coincidentally also played for Bud Presley and coached at Kenyatta Junior College in San Diego. And these are all the 6 degrees, but Jeff Corey was Bob's coach.
I went to some LaGarza camps in the Bay Area.
See, there we go. More 6 degrees. Yeah. So I know Jeff Corey. Jeff calls me and said, hey, this guy, Bob Myers, held his own against Mark Mattson, who went to San Ramon. And Mark Mattson is someone we were recruiting, goes on to Stanford, obviously plays for the Lakers, now coaching. Yeah. And so Bob comes down with his dad. We meet briefly. I'm encouraging him to walk on, think he could really help us because I respect Jeff Corey's opinion as high school coach. And if he held his own against Mark Mattson, he's definitely going to be a good practice player, walk-on candidate. But I could tell Bob didn't really think that was plausible because he's asking me about where the crew team coach is. And I was just being honest. I didn't even know where the crew team office was or who the coach was. And so I brought it back to, you know, hey, I'm sure, you know, you can find out, we'll make some calls, but what we're really emphasizing here is, you know, you're not going to be on the crew team because you're going to be helping us on the basketball team. And then I think he started to realize like, oh, wow, you know, but he still wanted to find out because he was thinking once they see me play, I won't be good enough and I better have the crew team experience to stay in shape. He's going to join a fraternity. And, you know, he had other, understandably, goals or objectives. And then he ends up making the team, eventually ends up getting a scholarship. We win a national title. He's on the cover of Sports Illustrated holding Tyus Edney after that buzzer-beating shot against Missouri, Lincoln the court, to extend our run in the NCAA tournament. We're on the Tonight Show.
The famous around the back. Yeah.
Yeah. He's on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He's in the White House with Bill Clinton. And so he just kind of has this wonderful Forrest Gump experience. It all started from, you know, Jeff Corey, his high school coach, sending him down to talk to me. And then obviously I present it to Coach Herrick. And then Bob performs. Most importantly, it's what he brought, what he did, his gifts. And then he worked an internship with Arne Tellem. And then after he graduates, goes to law school, continues to work for Arne, becomes a partner. Then he has this great run with the Golden State Warriors because Jerry West and Arne Tellem were very close. And yeah, when I came to UCLA as a volunteer assistant, my first year I'm working for free in Los Angeles, I worked out Arne Tellem's kids. They were probably 10 years old for $50. I worked out Jerry West's kid, Joey West, for $50. I worked out a guy named Steven Shapiro, who was big in real estate. His son, Max, I was working out for $50. And then Ed Weinberger, who had written for Johnny Carson. He was the writer of Mary Tyler Moore and Taxi, was the biggest sitcom writer in, you know, early 70s, you know, through probably early 80s, Laverne and Shirley. So we end up, you know, working out all their kids. That was $200. That helped me pay for my rent in a tough area of Venice. Those relationships from having worked those kids out come back into play. Ed Weinberger ended up being one of our best advocates and fans and a great mentor to Earl Watson. And the Shapiros were just helpful in terms of the community and real estate agents in that world. Obviously, Jerry West, you know, the logo and, you know, his brilliance and speaking to our players. And and then Arne Tellem ended up, you know, reviewing my contracts and he gave him Rob Pelinka sometimes once Arne joined his firm. Now, obviously, Rob's the Lakers general manager now, president GM now. So, yeah, really? Yeah. I mean, so many 6 degrees. I know these are quick hitters, but since you brought up Bob, you know, it really goes back to his coach, Jeff Corey. I got to give him the love first.
I selected my three favorite UCLA players from your era. And I'm going to ask you to describe them in one word each.
Oh, wow. That will be a quick hitter. Okay.
So we're going to go Baron Davis. One word.
Gifted.
Matt Barnes.
Versatile.
Earl Watson.
Brass nut. Oh, two.
Only That's one. A term. We can use that. That counts. We can let that slide. Or if you want to come up with one.
Warrior.
In hindsight now, are you surprised by how they've been able to kind of, you know, spread their wings into different business ventures? Like,
no. If it's one word, no. You know, you think about it, all three, right? Earl, NBA head coach, now broadcaster. Matt, both television, entrepreneurial, the whole cannabis element that, you know, he's aligned with. And from a business standpoint, brilliant. And then, you know, All the Smoke and Steven Jackson's chemistry with Matt, and how suited he is for this time in the world because of his authenticity. And
His sense of individuality, it just in like persistence and just saying, I'm going to stick to my guns. Like it's paying off in spades right now.
Yeah, he's killing it. Very bright. And then Baron, you know, has the gift also different than Matt and Earl. All three are gifted. They're all different. That's what's, in my view, great about coaching. I mean, if every player was a Stepford player and they all were the same. And I like same thing at St. John's. You know, I'm close to my UCLA guys in a way different than my St. John's kids. But I like the free spirit. I like kids that are challenging. I like the riddle, the problem solving. And I was probably better at St. John's in that regard than I was at UCLA, just because, like, parenting with their first child versus their fourth child. My parents talk about it with the six of us. They were dramatically different parents with my older sister, Rachel, or my oldest brother, John, than they were with my sister, Suzanne, who's number five, and myself, who's number six, because my parents were growing through the experience of raising children. It's no different in coaching with each year. I was a much better coach in year seven at UCLA, even though I was getting fired, my results weren't good, but I was a better coach in year seven than I was in year one, where my results were great. And I was a much better coach in my 50s at St. John's, you know, or late 40s and 50s at St. John's than I was in my early 30s at UCLA. And I'd be even a better coach now at 56 years old. And I was fortunate to be able to coach really interesting people, and then fortunate to be at great universities that helped put these young people on a positive trajectory.
Most listened to song, artist, or album of the pandemic?
Wow. It might be Quiet Nights, Bossa Nova, Antonio, Joe Beam, or is it Carlos? Maybe it's Carlos.
It's Carlos. Yeah. J-A-O-B-I-M, right?
Yes. Joe Beam. But also Earth, Wind, and Fire. I think it's Maurice White. But I've been all lately, it's been Anita Baker, you know, a lot of R&B. Oh, the Commodores. The one at Zoom.
Some soul R&B.
Actually, Zoom. It's so interesting. Zoom from the Commodores. Not the Zoom in terms of technology. That's, you know.
This is going to be tough to answer in a short form fashion, even though I know it's the rapid fire round. But we just passed the 1 year anniversary of Kobe's passing. Obviously, coaching at UCLA, there's a lot of folklore, a lot of stories of Kobe going and hooping there, just being a Laker and hooping in Westwood. So we'd love to hear a Kobe story if you have one for us.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a combination of elements. First, I recruited him, you know, because we wanted him to come to UCLA. So watched him while he was in high school. And we were well aware that more than likely, you know, he was going to go to the NBA. But still, we put in our efforts on the recruiting front. So I remember watching him as a player, and that was remarkable. And, you know, I had the sense, just like when I recruited, you know, evaluated LeBron, that he wasn't, you know, going to play in the NBA either. LeBron played at a Martin Luther King tournament, Pauley Pavilion. So was able to watch him play there. And Kobe was back.
I went to that game.
Oh, you did? Wow. And
I went to that.
I feel like it was like 2002, 2003, something like that.
Yep. ESPN broadcasted it. That was when they were broadcast. His high school team kind of went on like a national tour, and they were broadcasting all of the games nationally. Yep. I mean, it was a big deal.
Yeah. They stayed in our locker room. And I think he actually used Josiah Johnson's locker, from what I recall. And then Kobe was like Boo Williams, I think, back east tournament, if I'm not mistaken. And might've been on Maryland's campus even, like their older facility, before they kind of updated their facilities on campus. And then, you know, we shared the same agent, Arn Tellem, because I'd worked Arn Tellem's kids out. I'd gotten to know Arn, and, you know, Arn and Jerry West were close, and, you know, he ends up with the Lakers, represented by Arn. And so he did come to campus a lot. I mean, I remember him sitting in front of the Wooden Center after working out or getting a run in, or right before he's going to get his shots, or the men's gym where he played some as well and got workouts and runs in, or even up on Bruin Walk, you know, sitting on a bench and drinking a smoothie, you know, in the off season on a beautiful day. And it almost was as if he was recapturing or trying to capture what he missed, because he went straight to the pros. He didn't have that college experience, but living near campus, this was before he lived down in Orange County in Newport Coast. He lived near campus. And so I think he enjoyed the banter with our players in practices. You know, once we went to the full court, he would take the far courts and get his workouts. He'd be down there alone or someone, you know, shagging and you know, having him get shots up. And so, you know, our players were able to engage, interact with him. He'd sometimes be watching our practices. So he got his shots up. And then it's interesting, later when I was living in Orange County after my time at UCLA, we'd run into each other shopping down in that area. And so, yeah, there were just a lot of intersecting lines. And also his first year with the Lakers was my first year as a head coach. So just, you know, interesting. But our players obviously had mad respect for him. And and he was always good in terms of engaging with them, you know, and not having that attitude where I don't have time for you, you know.
Yeah.
So he definitely made an impression on that entire generation of people, in particular being our UCLA guys who were around him more than any other college players in the country. I think they gleaned, got more out of spending time with Kobe than anyone else.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Rest in peace, Kobe. And on that note, let's wrap it up. One thought: we got to get you a podcast, and it's time for you to start letting it rip on the mic. I think this is a great format for you.
Oh, I appreciate that.